KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I-44.
It took a while for me to be at a dinner table and say, well, yeah, I'm an animal communicator, and kind of see the responses.
Oh, you're the most wonderful cinnamon bear in the whole wide world.
It's really nice of you to say it.
Smoke it! Light it up!
Yeah, the law changed and people were excited last night. We're going to talk about the implications for the new pot rules. We're also going to hear about the radio show Cinnamon Bear. I understand a lot of you loved that show and still love it when you find it on the web. For those of you who have never heard the holiday radio program Cinnamon Bear, you're in for a treat. A sweet, sweet, very sweet, treacly sweet treat. Not that I'm biased. We're also going to hear from Rachel Milliken, who's an animal communicator. All coming up this hour. Much more, too. But we start with pot. Just how big is the potential market for pot in the U.S.? Marijuana has been legal to possess in Washington State for, about 10 hours now? There's a lot to figure out. Seattle police officers have been told to issue only verbal warnings for violations. The law allows for possession and use in privacy in your home, but not buying or selling. City Attorney Pete Holmes says we're in uncharted territory, trying to substitute a legal license system for what is nearly a wholly illegal system. That was a quote. But he says, at least we're not doing any more harm. The State Liquor Control Board has a year to figure out how to set up Washington's marijuana market. Growers and suppliers of the state's medical marijuana industry are looking at a major business opportunity. The state projected that marijuana could be a $1 billion market in Washington state. Seattle Times reports that would put pot just behind apples as Washington state's most profitable cash crop. And who isn't thinking about combining those in some way? Aaron Smith is executive director of the National Cannabis Industry Association, working on behalf of cannabis-related business at the national level. He joins us from Colorado. Aaron Smith, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Are you stationed in Colorado?
We're actually based out of Washington, D.C. and focused on lobbying on behalf of the industry. But, you know, we have a membership base here in Colorado, and as the second state that has also legalized adult use and sales of marijuana, it's certainly one of our headquarters, for sure.
What work are you doing in Colorado now that legalization is taking place there, too?
Well, you know, it's a similar track as what you have in Washington, where we've got, you know, 18 months for the state to figure out, you know, what the regulations are going to look like before we actually see stores opening that are able to sell into the adult market. But, you know, this is pretty exciting because we're looking at, you know, you quoted the $1 billion figure in Washington and extrapolating that across the country, assuming that 50 states eventually follow the lead of Washington and Colorado, which I think they will. We're looking at $46 billion nationally, which is about almost half of what the bulk sales of alcohol looks like in this country.
How did the National Cannabis Industry Association get started?
Well, we represent state legal cannabis businesses, and so at this point, what that means is medical cannabis businesses. And in 2010, a number of business owners from California, Colorado, Washington, and elsewhere joined together to start advocating for our business interests at the national level. There are some enormous challenges that we face due to outdated federal law, and just like any other industry, we're stepping up to represent our own interests and get those laws changed.
When you talk about the challenges, of course, one challenge is perception and the reality of who controls the market now and how pot is delivered to its users. What are the first steps you think need to be taken so that marijuana becomes a more legitimate product and is going to be seen, regulated, and licensed as a legitimate product in Washington State, in Colorado, to start with?
Well, you know, we're certainly looking forward to seeing some sensible regulations come out of both states. to license and regulate the sales to adults, just as we do with alcohol. And I have all the confidence in the world in both Washington and Colorado that that's what we will see in the next 18 months. And it's important to understand that the alternative is selling marijuana in a black market. Black marketeers and illegal drug dealers do not card. They do not pay taxes. They do not operate in a responsible manner, such as that will be mandated and expected of the businesses that will be opening up in 2014 in these two states.
Have you thought about the number of people it might take to regulate the industry from the growing operation right down to the person who's selling it at a retail operation?
I haven't looked at that, I guess, scientifically, but I would think that, you know, we're talking of a few dozen new state jobs to, you know, license and enforce the regulations on the new businesses in Washington. And this is, of course, you know, we're going to see tax windfall, which will cover that. There's $1,000 annual licensing fees for the centers that will be opening in Washington, which will help cover the cost of regulation. And then that $1 billion figure you quoted, 25% of that is going to go into sales tax, which will pay for schools, infrastructure, and other vital services.
But when you look at the industry now, you represent legal cannabis providers. What issues arise now in trying to keep the legal cannabis going to the legal users and not being diverted into an illegal stream? And how will that be affected by reforms in Washington State or Colorado?
Well, it'll absolutely it'll undercut the black market and reduce the odds that children will be able to get their hands on marijuana. Just as, you know, right now you ask anybody, any high school student, it's a lot easier for them to obtain marijuana in school than it is for them to obtain beer. And that's because, somebody who sells alcohol actually has an incentive to make sure that they're following the law so that they don't lose their license, as a drug dealer does not.
But do you think the black market will dry up because the marijuana will be cheaper in the retail stores?
Certainly, and not just the price, but also, you know, consumers want to be able to walk into a legitimate business and obtain this product just like they would anything else. And, you know, if you have an opportunity, you don't see people out there selling beer on the street because there's just no real demand for that. And I think that, you know, this is, you know, at first in Colorado and Washington, but ultimately by implementing these sorts of laws across the country will eliminate millions and millions of dollars that are going into illegal drug cartels that are in some cases horrifically violent in south of the border.
Sure, but how do you keep the question that people always ask is, how do you keep those illegal cartels from moving their product into the legal system? I mean, that's where it seems that law enforcement and any kind of a system set up by the state is going to have to focus its attention.
There's no real incentive to do that. The illegal cartels, they're just that. They're operating under a black market, and there's no incentive for them to get involved in the legal market. They're not involved in the alcohol market. They're not selling tobacco. And, you know, I don't see any reason to believe that they would all of a sudden get involved in a legally regulated market for marijuana. And, you know, these guys are making their money on basically because of prohibition. And, you know, they will continue to peddle other drugs once we, you know, I'm sure, but we will not, you know, and it's important to know that 85% of the drugs consumed in this country is marijuana. So this is a huge hit to these underground dealers.
Aaron Smith, have you had any contact through the National Cannabis Industry Association with the Washington State Liquor Control Board at this point?
No, we focus our efforts on changing federal law. So there are, certainly affiliate organizations in Washington that are working with the Liquor Control Board and others to help in the, you know, assistance in the drafting of the regulation. But that's not really our purview.
And what do you think? Go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, go ahead.
What do you think about the federal government? What do you expect to hear anything from them about Colorado or Washington in the next few days? Do you expect they'll be quiet for the next year?
Well, it's your guess is as good as mine, but I think that I'm certainly hopeful that what we'll get is a statement that the federal government is not going to be using its resources to undermine the will of the voters and undermine state laws on this issue. This, you know, clearly by passing these laws in two states with wide majority support, we're seeing that, that, you know, the Obama administration, I think, knows that, you know, it's politically a nightmare for them to delve into this. And, you know, clearly there are a lot of challenges beyond what you're alluding to with the Department of Justice potentially prosecuting marijuana producers and retailers. There are other issues that need to be sorted out. One huge one is that that billion-dollar market that, that you're talking about, without some changes to the Department of Treasury regulations on banking regulations, we could clearly see that market be almost cash only, which is a nightmare for not only the business owners, but for those who are tasked with regulating those businesses. So we're calling on the federal government to change the banking regulations, which are currently forcing medical marijuana businesses into a cash business because of outdated banking regulations. We're asking to change that. And additionally, you know, ultimately we want to see the federal government get out of the business of prohibition altogether.
More steps on the road to legalizing marijuana. Aaron Smith is Executive Director of the National Cannabis Industry Association. Thank you for taking the time.
Hey, thank you.
You're listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
When you're going to school, it's what you learn that matters, not where you learn, right?
Seeing all of their faces when they walk through the door, like, oh my gosh, look at this place. We're going to a real school.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The unintended consequences of giving a school a facelift. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:16.
Support for KUOW comes from the School of Teaching ESL, presenting an information session on training options to teach English as a second language in the U.S. or overseas at 7 p.m. Monday, December 10th in North Seattle. Details and registration at schoolofTESL.com.
Clouds and rain, 46 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today. Temperatures in the mid-40s. Tonight, clouds and rain, temperatures in the upper 30s. Same for tomorrow, cloudy, rainy, and breezy. Highs in the mid-40s.
Katie Sewell's been profiling people's interesting jobs. We need some more suggestions. Weekday at KUOW.org. Interesting jobs in the subject line. Today, we meet Rachel Milliken, who works as an animal communicator.
She still has a day job, but she's been busy communicating with animals for her clients at night. She can do dogs, cats, horses, fish. She has suggested to me that my fish would like a bigger tank, which I agree with. I agree with.
Is she like a fish whisperer?
Oh, you'll find out.
All right.
You'll find out. But before we find out exactly what animal communication is, let's sit in on a session that she recently had.
So my name's Rachel Milliken. I am the founder of Beyond Barking, and what I do is communicate with animals telepathically using images, sound, sense of knowing, clairvoyance, clairsentient, things of this sort, and am planning on working with you today, Jody, in regards to Ulysses. And it seems all in all, Ulysses is a very happy and well taken care of boy, but we have some changes happening, and he is clearly responding to those, so we're going to get some clarification on precisely what is going on.
Great. Well, my name is Jody Rick, and I am the mother of Ulysses. Ulysses is a 75-pound mix. We believe he is a lab Shar-Pei Mastiff mix. He kind of looks like a small horse or a miniature Great Dane. He's 3.5 about now, and we've had him since he was 8 weeks old. He is a very, very sweet knucklehead who in the house is calm and loving and just a little snuggle bug. And the moment he steps outside, he is a madman. So.
And have you done any training with him?
Oh, yes, we've done a variety of training.
That's what I was kind of getting the idea of.
Yeah.
Okay. So we corresponded on email and you sent me a bunch of photos so that I could see this handsome boy as well, who is very large. You had also sent me some questions, things that have been bouncing around your mind. One of the questions you brought up was that he's a really social guy and that lately, he started to curl up in a different room and out of sight from you when you're home, spend some time on his own, which you're not accustomed to. And so your question was, what's going on in his mind and is he depressed, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to check in with you, Ulysses, and we're going to find out what's going on in
cool.
his mind. I'm going to take my shoes off. They're going to fall off. They're clogs and they're just hanging. Normally, he's always in your space.
Oh, yeah, always, yeah.
And now, it's been really kind of in the last 2 months, eh?
I'd say two to four months, probably.
Okay. And now he's going to his own space.
Okay. Which is new behavior for him. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, perfect. So let's just check in with him a second and see what's going on. He's feeling really more at ease with you being around. And so instead of needing to follow you and watch what you're doing and where you're going and when you're going to be leaving and all of the busy stuff that you're always doing all the time running around, he is more at ease and comfortable going to just lay down and chill out.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. And I am getting from him also that his demeanor has shifted that way, where you are seeing a change in him, kind of like he's growing up a little bit. Instead of being the baby that has to follow you, he's really just being a big boy.
That's good, because there would be a lot more new things happening.
He's not depressed.
Good.
He's not depressed at all. He's really happy. He knows new things are happening, and he's giving you some space.
You said he knows that things are changing somewhat. So what is he perceiving in terms of my changing body as a, and I'm now 9 months pregnant for the listeners.
Okay. So obviously he can see your body and smell your body and know that your body's changing. But what he has picked up on is the interaction you and your husband have had about another being coming into the house. Mm. He's also really excited about this. He wants this to work. He doesn't want to be a problem. He wants to be included in the whole process.
That's great.
Yeah. He's really excited.
We can't wait to see him nuzzle that baby. Rachel Milliken is an animal communicator. Is that what you call yourself, animal communicator?
Yes.
What is an animal communicator?
Animal communicator is someone who uses all of their senses to receive information from animals. Everyone is an animal communicator. It's a matter of how available they are to their senses. I get pictures from them, and I get, which would be clairvoyance, and then I get audio, clairaudient, and then, of course, there's the clairsentience, the knowing information. Like, you're walking through your house, and you go into the kitchen, and all of a sudden you say, oh, I should check the dog's bowls. And then you go over to the dog bowl and the dog bowl is out of water. There's a pretty high chance that the dog has communicated to you as you walk by the bowls, hey, there's no water in my bowl. I mean, you're busy. You got 100 things going on in your brain. They were able to get through to you in that split second of time.
Give me an example of something you would hear auditorially.
I will get words from animals. And sometimes the word will just repeat itself over and over. I had a dog. The dog said, go out of the sliding door and turn right, turn right, turn right, turn right. So, I mean, there's no question in my mind that this information needed to go to this person's owner. And in fact, there was a situation where he went, there was a sliding door, which I didn't know because I hadn't been to the house, and he turned right and he had found something that he didn't know was there.
Hmm.
So.
What kind of a thing?
This was a situation where, unfortunately, he had someone, a peeping Tom, a voyeur, had worn a footpath along the side of the house to the back windows of the house. And so, yeah, a little freaky. That's a little freaky when stuff like that happens, especially when it's unexpected.
How do you know that you're right?
Really, the validation comes from the person. I have no idea if I'm right or wrong at all. I'm just functioning as a conduit for the information to come in from the animal. Another case in point as far as words is there was a dog named Weedle at the Homeward Pet where I had been volunteering, and it was the end of the night and it was dark, and We're putting all the dogs, kind of to sleep for the night, shall I say. And Wido had been there a while, and I was laying on the floor with him on his bed, and he says, "Why do I keep getting returned?" And that's how it
was
came
that his
in.
Voice?
That's how it came in. "Why do I keep getting returned?" My heart felt so sad. My eyes welled up with tears, and I just said, "You know, I don't know the answer to that, but you're such a good boy. And if you can just make sure you're nice to people when they walk by your kennel, I know you're getting used to being here and he's barking at people when they come by their kennel. So if you could just be nice to people, the perfect home will come for you." After we left, I ran out to the gal who was kind of the operator overseeing all the volunteers. And I said, "Would you be willing to pull the file on Weedle? Has he been adopted out before and returned? I mean, I know he's been here, you know, a couple months." And she said, "Oh, he was just returned the other day again." Three times he'd been returned, adopted and returned. This is when you know, like, you could say, am I crazy? But when someone validates the information, you know it's just a matter of being available.
How does that change how you view the world? It's almost, what you're talking about, it's almost like having a magical power. As a child, we all wished we knew what animals were thinking.
It's not a magical power. I think that the human body is the same that it's always been, and the world around us has changed so drastically that we, in many ways, have shut down.
Rachel Milliken is an animal communicator. I'm sure it's a wide variety of responses, but when you tell people what you do for a living, I'm sure people, there are a sect of people out there listening now that are skeptical at
absolutely
at best.
Understood. So just a little background. I have an English lit degree. I have a master's in organizational management. Consider myself a very run-of-the-mill normal person. And I would say probably for a while, I didn't even tell people because it's a little weird. It's not mainstream. So let's define weird as not being mainstream. And I grew up where mainstream is what you're supposed to be. So it took a while for me to be at a dinner table and say, "Well, yeah, I'm an animal communicator," and kind of see the responses. So, you know, how do you prove these things to people? Again, you can only prove it through doing the work and then having the human validate what their animal companion is or is not experiencing. And time again, when I do sessions and send the information off to the folks, or they take that information and they reread it or re-listen to it or revisit it and implement what's been suggested by their animal companion, they are blown away.
So if people are interested in trying this, communicating with their animals or trying to be more open to the messages around them, is there an exercise that you would suggest?
People are very good at painting a picture in their mind, and animals receive images very easily. Something that could easily be tried with a dog is maybe just sitting in a chair and sending them a picture of their leash and their collar and going out the front door and going for a walk and see their response. Some may receive that, some may not. If they don't receive that, then you could attempt sending a message just verbally to them, not out loud, but saying, "Do you want to go for a ride?" Sending the picture, sending the words, sending the feeling of going, and see what kind of response you get from the animal.
Rachel Milliken is an animal communicator. Thanks, Rachel, for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
She works at Beyond Barking. Katie Sewell will be back with more animal stories in just a few minutes. This is Weekday. Same-sex marriage became legal in Washington state last night. People were lined up around the block at the King County Administration Building. They were going to get their licenses so that they would be married December Sunday. Some were getting married Sunday, some Monday. We talked to a few people about why they were lined up, why they were getting married.
Well, we're queued up outside of the county building, just off of 4th Avenue. My name is Robert Sledge.
My name's Don.
Well, we're here with all the rest. We felt that it's important that we come right away when it first opened, even though we don't intend to get married in the next 3 days. But this is a statement for us to show that we're solidarity with the rest of the gay population of Seattle and King County.
Personal question, how long have you both been out?
I've been out since I was probably 16 years old, which would be in excess of 40 years.
So we're talking the 60s.
Easily.
More mid to late 90s. It means a recognition within the state of Washington for us to be recognized as spouses. And that's a significant change.
How long have you both been together?
We're going on our 9th year.
9 years?
Yes.
Did you ever say to yourselves, if we could, we want to get married?
We had talked about going to New York when New York was allowing marriage, and we have had friends who did go there, and we wanted it to wait until Washington did it, because we felt Washington would be opening its doors to marriage, and it would be a matter of time. So we're excited that it's happened.
Oh, it was definitely always in the back of the mind, always. You know, everybody else in your family, you know, they talk about marriage. It's kind of like people said. It basically says, you know, what you feel for the other person. It's a commitment.
Chrissy Galinsky.
Hi, Lindsay. Hi, Gardner.
How long have you been together?
Almost 3 years now.
And big day to get married, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's exciting to be out here and be a part of history. It's mainly why we came out tonight, so we'll pass our bedtime, but...
Yeah, mine too. Yeah. When are you planning on getting married?
Actually, the 12th of December, up on Capitol Hill at Cupcake Royale.
Yeah. So you guys are ready.
Yeah. I just proposed to her this past weekend at Cupcake Royale as well. I ordered cupcakes, had them set up a spread that said, "Lindsay, will you marry me?" She had no idea. It's been planned out for probably a month.
That's nice. Yeah. Did you ever think you'd get that much romance?
No, I didn't. And it's still surreal, and the shock is not over yet. I felt like I was in a movie. Like, who is that romantic?
You know, marriage is a big deal. You're not a little nervous about getting married?
No, not at all. From the moment I met Lindsay, I knew that she was the person I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And I have been clawing to be able to stand here today.
Be part of working on the campaign to get...
No, not too much. I mean, we're not really activists in that way, I guess. I mean, we give a little bit of money here and there, but we don't really go out and do much.
Yeah, I mean, I probably did my fair share of, you know, I like this page and promoting it for them on Facebook. But, like actual out on the street stuff, not as much.
But marriage was important to you.
Absolutely.
When you were younger, too? Before this all became a political issue?
I wasn't even sure I was somebody who wanted to be married, but when I met Lindsay, she clarified it all for me, and I knew at that moment that she was the person I wanted to be with.
I don't know, I've always wanted to, I guess. I had a great example with my parents, so they showed me what it could be like when it's good, so, and I found it already so young.
And you wanted to be out here tonight because this was important.
It's the first day of a new civil right. It's a historic moment that will go down forever, and we can always say that we were a part of that. It's very special.
Chrissy Galinsky, Lindsay Hamm-Gardner, Robert Sledge, and Don talking about the reasons why they were out last night at the King County building getting the licenses so they could be married. Peter Nicholas is a law professor at the University of Washington studying these issues. Professor Nicholas, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
You know, one of the people we talked to didn't want to give their whole name, didn't want to talk at first because they said, you know, the major manufacturing company in our state isn't so comfortable with gay marriage because they are an international company and they operate under the laws of the Defense of Marriage Act. The rules of the Defense of Marriage Act. How big a part of DOMA are these questions about the states? Are these questions for states that are allowing marriage? What impact is DOMA having on these corporations that operate among all the states?
Well, as most people have known for a long time, even though the first step in the process is getting states to permit same-sex couples to marry, the real obstacle for a lot of the rights of marriage that matter to a lot of couples come from the federal government. And DOMA really is currently standing in the way as an obstacle to same-sex married couples fully receiving the rights and privileges normally associated with marriage. And in the particular case, I think you're talking about, I believe, Boeing and their pension plans. And of course, there's nothing in federal law that prohibits Boeing from deciding to extend those pension rights to same-sex couples, but it's currently available to companies like Boeing as a shield to choose not to extend those rights, in part because federal law basically preempts any state regulation of employee benefit plans.
Some major corporations have decided to extend those benefits.
That's right, yes. And obviously, a lot of companies choose to do that. And I think from what I've read, I think in light of some of the public attention that's been brought to this particular issue, even Boeing is reconsidering its position.
What's the legislative and political lay of the land here going forward? Have we reached a tipping point because Washington being the first state to pass marriage equality at the ballot box?
Well, it certainly psychologically has changed the game in the sense that it's no longer correct to say that every time this issue goes to the ballot box, it loses. And I think one of the effects that's had is actually to make legislators in other states feel more comfortable about the possibility of moving forward with this. A lot of people actually think, for example, in our state that it was gay marriage that pushed Jay Inslee into office rather than, you know, anything else, that he actually rode on the coattails of the same-sex marriage vote. In terms of a tipping point, I think what you're going to see is very incremental change in the sense that some of the states that currently have civil unions or domestic partnerships, I think you're going to see possibly moving in the direction of marriage, states like Delaware and Rhode Island and possibly New Jersey. And then you may see a couple of states like Colorado and Minnesota, going from having nothing or virtually nothing for same-sex couples to having something like civil unions or domestic partnerships. But that's probably in the short term where you're going to see the legislative activity. And perhaps in a state like Oregon, trying to do something like Maine did and go to the ballot box and try to get voters to change their constitutional amendment, I could see something like that possibly being pursued as well.
Anything that from Congress on DOMA at this point?
I don't think Congress itself, the extent to which it's divided right now, I don't think you would actually see legislative repeal of DOMA, but any day now we could hear from the U.S. Supreme Court about whether or not they're going to review one of the many cases that has struck down DOMA. And so far, every federal court that's considered these challenges to DOMA has struck it down. So they have a lot of choices to consider about which case to take.
The lower court strike it down on the virtue of what, equal protection?
Equal protection, that's right.
So what about, we were looking at other countries, and Mexico, they seem to be moving forward with getting rid of bans on same-sex marriage.
Sure, and one of the things, Mexico is subject to one of many international treaties, and through reference to that treaty, there was a successful challenge to the prohibition on same-sex couples marrying. In our country, we're not going to see anything like a Mexico decision anytime soon for two reasons. One, most of the cases that are before the U.S. Supreme Court are going to have very limited impact that deal with same-sex marriage. The DOMA cases are only going to immediately decide whether couples who are in states where marriage is recognized can get the benefits of marriage, and the Perry case from California striking down Prop 8 is such an unusually narrow decision that it's unlikely to have broad effect. And just the way the U.S. Supreme Court normally decides cases, they don't like to decide it any broader than it needs to be. That said, when the right case gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, the fact that you have things like this Supreme Court decision in Mexico are relevant. If you go back to Lawrence versus Texas striking down sodomy laws, one of the things the U.S. Supreme Court relied on were some of these decisions by foreign tribunals and looking to sort of international principles of human rights. So it might have a longer-term effect, but in the short term, it's going to take us a while to get there.
Professor Nicholas, I appreciate you talking to us about it.
Thank you.
We will continue to track it. Peter Nicholas is a law professor at the University of Washington. By the way, Netherlands passed same-sex marriage equality in 2001, Spain in 2005, Canada. The U.S. is still catching up. This is Weekday.
It's 10:40. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. Are you planning on getting married now that same-sex marriage is legal in Washington State? KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls at 12:40 today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. Tell us why you're getting hitched, or perhaps why not. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from the Willows Inn on Lummi Island, serving a menu of locally fished, foraged, and farmed ingredients prepared by Chef Blaine Wetzel, now booking waterfront retreats and catered holiday events. More information and online gift certificates at willows-inn.com.
Clouds and showers, 46 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the temperature in the mid-40s. We're expecting clouds and showers tonight as well, and tomorrow. Tonight's low 39, tomorrow's high 44.
Support for KUOW comes from Edmonds Community College, offering hands-on and industry experience in energy analysis and assessment, energy accounting, and commercial lighting. Classes start January 2nd. More about the energy management program at edcc.edu/energy.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
I first started listening to old-time radio shows. They were on Cairo a lot. And all around the holidays, instead of getting to hear my favorite detectives, I had to listen to The Cinnamon Bear over and over again. And really, I know a lot of you like The Cinnamon Bear, and you were raised in the Northwest listening to The Cinnamon Bear on radio when you were little kids, and maybe other older little kids have been exposed to it. But me, I wanted to put a stick in my eye. But I am, as Katie has reminded me, one man in a world of public opinion. And so we turn to you, Katie Bear, to tell us how the Cinnamon Bear adventure came to be.
Yes, just because you don't like the Cinnamon Bear doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about the Cinnamon Bear.
A stick in my eye, Katie.
Well, the Cinnamon Bear series was made in 1937. As a daily radio entertainment for kids running from Thanksgiving to Christmas time. 26 episodes.
26, exactly.
Running Monday through Friday in 15-minute intervals, and each story ended with a cliffhanger, so you had to tune in the next day. And the story follows the adventures of Judy and Jimmy, who meet the Cinnamon Bear, Patio Cinnamon, up in the attic while they're trying to find a missing silver star that they usually have on top of the family Christmas tree.
Say, Jimmy, ask if he's a really, truly live real bear.
All right. Hey, Teddy Bear, tell us, who are you?
I'm the Cinnamon Bear with the human eyes, and I'm looking for someone to take by surprise. I go prowling and growling each night after dark. But the folks say my growl's just a cinnamon bar.
Oh, did I mention it's a musical? It's also a musical. It had original songs written for it. So the adventure continues as the kids and the cinnamon bear enter a magical world called Maybeland to find the crazy quilt dragon that has stolen the Silver Star. And it probably doesn't surprise you, Steve, hearing the plot of this story, that this was created to boost department store sales.
It does not.
Much like the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was, which...
Hey, don't be going down on my friend Rudolph now.
Well, you know, you remember that Rudolph was written by a low-paid in-house copywriter named Robert L. May just so Montgomery Ward had something to pass out for the holidays. And then it caught on and became part of our Christmas lore.
Our Christmas traditions are really sad. Isn't that where Kris Kringle came? I mean, the whole...
Well, visiting him, yes.
Yeah.
So the Cinnamon Bear was created by Transco Productions of Hollywood, which was one of the more prolific developers of syndicated programming when radio was just getting started. And the program was made so that department stores could become paying sponsors of it. And along with radio advertising time, the sponsoring department store also got window displays they could put up of the Cinnamon Bear. They got sheet music from the show that they could give out to people who were buying stuff in their stores. And they also got a Cinnamon Bear costume so that kids could come to their store to visit the Cinnamon Bear while they were also coming to visit
Cinnamon. I like that. Mm-hmm. So did you do either? So how long did this tradition go on?
In some places, it's still going on.
So there's somebody in a Cinnamon Bear costume handing out, I hope, cinnamon candy.
If you live in Portland this year, you can go on the Cinnamon Bear cruise for $30.
Will there be a man in a Cinnamon Bear costume?
I have no idea, but there's a Cinnamon Bear themed cruise every year.
You brought in these quite remarkable old ads from... Well, here's Listen to the Cinnamon Bear Story on KEX 1190 at 6:45 p.m. And Lippmann's, this is from 1974, the Oregonian. And have fun with the Cinnamon Bear, because he'll be downtown.
Yes, and Lippmann's department store in Portland were the huge early sponsors of the Cinnamon Bear. And then when they got bought out in 1979, Frederick and Nelson took over the Cinnamon Bear tradition and kept it going until they went bankrupt in 1991, I think. So if you love the Cinnamon Bear or you hate it, it was the first job for a lot of really famous radio actors. Because remember, this is 1937, so it's early, early radio. And I thought it would be fun to hear some examples of people we know.
I hope they're singing.
Yes. So here's the crazy quilt dragon, the character that stole the Silver Star.
Why? I don't understand. What does all this mean?
You know what it means, Crazy Quilt. We've got you this time.
Where's our Silver Star?
Silver Star? What Silver Star?
Don't try to quibble, Crazy Quilt. Hand it over gratefully and you can go your way.
Oh, what a terrible mistake you've made. Why, I've never seen this Silver Star you're talking about.
So that's Joseph Kearns, who began his acting career on the radio with this role, as well as a few roles in Lux Radio Theater. But you might remember him in your listening experience, Steve, as the man who guards Jack Benny's underground vault.
Children, what in the world are you doing? Get up off the floor. You're all tangled up in that old crazy quilt.
Well, that's the wrong one. That can't be that man guarding his vault.
Say, Ed, how long have you been down here?
Oh, it's been years and years. I guess I sort of lost track.
I'm going to take you up with me right now. Now, follow me.
All right.
Be careful. Ed, what happened?
You forgot to unchain me.
And he also, I was interested to find out, he also was this host on the mystery show Suspense.
This is the Man in Black, here again to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense. Miss Moorhead returns to our stage to appear in a new study in terror by Lucille Fletcher called Sorry, Wrong Number.
Oh, that was a good one, too.
Yeah, yeah. And he's all over. I mean, look up Joseph Kearns. He's in every show that you can possibly find. Let's do a few more, shall we?
Good to know he had his start in Cinnamon Bear.
Yeah, that was the crazy quilt dragon, his premier role. Let's do a few more of people who made their break in the Cinnamon Bear. The mother of Judy and Jimmy was played by a woman named Verna Felton.
Children, what in the world are you doing? Get up off the floor. You're all tangled up in that old crazy quilt.
Now, she worked in radio and film for 40 years, and modern audiences mainly remember her as the fairy godmother in Cinderella.
Salagadoola, Mentricaboola, Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Put them together, and what have you got? Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Salagadoola, Mentricaboola.
Yeah, more singing.
Yeah.
But this is Disney singing.
This is Disney singing. She also
doesn't have that Cinnamon Bear quality.
Right. She also is the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland, interestingly enough.
Really? Well, off with her head.
Yeah. Now, then there's the character Samuel the Seal.
I'm Samuel the Trained Seal.
Like the ones in the circus?
Have you seen them? Amateurs, my boy. Just amateurs. You haven't seen a thing until you've seen me perform.
Now, that's Howard McNear, who is better known as Doc Adams in the show Gunsmoke.
It's not time that saves a patient, Mrs. Crumley. It's knowledge. Knowledge I don't have.
You know what there is to know, Doc. Nobody knows more.
Her husband's dead, Mrs. Crumley. I wanted to save him.
Oh.
That's a, quite a big change, isn't it?
That's kind of a downer you just brought. I was on my cinnamon bear, cinnamon high. Now you're bringing me down.
I wanted to bring you back down to reality. So should we do one more? One more?
As long as there's some singing, Katie. Is there singing?
No, but there's some rapid-fire humor.
Oh, I like the rapid-fire humor.
All right, let's listen to Elliot Lewis playing Mr. Presto, the magician.
I take magic lessons by mail, very good, too, but after I produced all these rabbits out of my hat, I couldn't get rid of them. Keep following me around all the time and yelling for carrots. Very annoying, very annoying.
This character talks like that the whole time, too. I'm not sure what the thinking there from the director was, but he went on to be one of the most prolific directors on the radio. He eventually directed the show Suspense. He also did the show Broadway Is My Beat in 1950. He was also a writer and a producer and an actor on the radio for his entire career. But it all began with his very first recorded performance ever in The Cinnamon Bear. So, if you've decided
you've really got me thinking about The Cinnamon Bear again. Maybe I need to give it another shot.
Well, and if you want to, or if you've never heard it and you want to check it out for yourself, kids still like The Cinnamon Bear, by the way, even if adults don't. If you're intrigued and you want to listen, I put a link on our website where you can listen to all of the episodes, and you can also find it at our Facebook page, Weekday on KYW.
That's because it can be found on so various people on the interwebs have posted the entire show, huh?
Yeah, there's a man who blogs every year and reposts all 26 episodes of The Cinnamon Bear so that he can keep his holiday tradition alive and get it started for other people.
I know you said that some of our fellow coworkers were excited to hear about The Cinnamon Bear being discussed.
Yes, they were. Stephanie up in the front office was a Cinnamon Bear fan when she was a kid. A
Cinnamon Bearophile.
Is that what they're called? Oh, well, I didn't get that.
All right, then. I will reconsider The Cinnamon Bear.
Well, at least you can listen for all your favorite actors. There's so many more, too. Everybody's in that show.
Katie, I think I need something sweet for lunch now. Sarah Dickerman, are you thinking that perhaps you could send us somewhere sweet for lunch?
Well, sure. You can definitely have some shave ice where I'm thinking of sending you. I love the new location for the Marination. You know, there's a Marination food truck. And now they have a new location on West Seattle on Alki Beach, looking out at the amazing skyline. And one of the things they serve is shave ice, which is like, actually shaved ice topped with delicious, very sweet syrups that the kids love.
Oh, the Hawaiians know how to make that. Mm-hmm. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, New York Times, and other publications. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. We have links there, and she joins us every Thursday to give us a lunch recommendation. These guys, the Marination Mobile, they've been really sort of reshaping our idea of what Hawaiian food is and also what mobile food is.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think we've talked before about that really cool model where, you know, the people who are organized and get a good food truck together can use that as a springboard into some actual brick-and-mortar locations. And they've done that. The Alki location is actually their second brick-and-mortar shop, but this one is it's quite big, and it's right on the water taxi dock. And yeah, as you said, Hawaiian food is really interesting because, of course, it was always a hybridized culture because you had the Portuguese influence from sort of the seafaring communities And then you have Japanese and Chinese influences, and then, of course, good old, you know, American influences like ever-present Spam.
Yeah. No, and that's best. I love it when Spam is served well. That's what, one of the things I learned about Hawaiian food, and also what I look forward to, it, you know, getting those kinds of great tacos with a little Spam in them sometimes. Do you like their sliders?
Confess, I'm not the biggest Spam fan. I know that that's sacrilege in that particular category of food. But there's so many other good things. There's all these delicious marinated meat. They do these tacos with different kinds of marinated meats. You can get, you know, sort of a Korean-style kalbi beef taco with a lovely shredded, you know, cabbage-y slaw on top. Or ginger chicken, miso-marinated ginger chicken in a taco. It's all really good stuff. And they have this delicious sort of sweet, spicy nunya sauce that they put on their tacos. And then at the new location, they have quite a good fish and chip setup with a panko crust. You know, that's the wonderful Japanese breadcrumbs that are sort of almost like crushed-up cornflakes in texture. And they make a really nice coating for frying.
Yeah. I like the looks of their sliders too. And
yeah,
they're and
yummy.
Yeah, and they have a Spam. They have a Spam slider.
or pulled pork if you're into sort of the more it's almost like a barbecue style pork slider that's delicious. And then my husband got this crazy sandwich that they serve at the Maikai, I think only, although I'm not sure. It's a pork katsu sandwich, so it's a breaded pork cutlet on a big old Macrina bun. It was enormous, and he loved it. He ate it all. He confessed he may have eaten a little too much.
And they like their kimchi too. That's what makes such a fun place.
Yeah.
All these different
flavors. Yeah, with the fish and chips, they have a kimchi tartar sauce that's really tasty.
So Marination Mobile and the Marination
Macai. Yeah, nice and casual, and it's a great place if you're going with your family for a walk, and maybe you have an out-of-town family, and you're going for a walk on Alki. It's a great place to land.
Now, what about a little flavor of a cookbook here?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a lot of great local cookbooks that I should be thinking about as we're thinking about holiday seasons, and one of the really nice ones that's come out is a second cookbook from the Macrina Bakery from Leslie Mackey, who's the wonderful baker who started Macrina. And it's, you know, it's very well-written recipes for the home cook, for everything from their sort of classic, they make such interesting flatbreads and sort of high moisture, wonderfully bubbly textured breads, to, you know, great muffins, you know, that we see at the coffee shops. And they're, like, even better when you make them at home. I made the cranberry gingerbread muffins they have a recipe for, and they were a big hit in my family.
Yum. All right, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
More Macrina favorites, Seattle's Neighborhood, Leslie Mackey's book. And if you're thinking about going out, Marination Macai and Alki, or you can look at their website for the Marination Mobile and other places, too. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano. Andy Hurst is our engineer. Amina Alsadi, also a producer. We get help from our interns, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, and Alexander Garrettin, who went out with me last night, talked to the folks that were gathered. Katie Sewell, you know, you're talking about the Cinnamon Bear, and it got us thinking about the music of the Cinnamon Bear, which is lovely. And I hope I'm not ruining anybody's music, but, you know, what music comes to your mind when we talk about the Cinnamon Bear? Little Neil Young, maybe?
Little Neil Young.
Get that treacly out with a little Cinnamon Girl.
I can picture a guy in a Cinnamon Bear costume.
Oh, now you see, you ruined it for me.
Good morning, it's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News in less than 2 minutes. Stay tuned. Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Sleep Company, handcrafting chemical-free, organic, and all-natural mattresses, pillows, and comforters from locally sourced suppliers for more than 30 years. More information online at SoaringHeart.com.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, the Associated Press has decided to stop using the term homophobia. The psychotherapist who coined it says they need a suitable replacement.
Not all rage, not all hatred is phobic, but we have no word coming even close. And part of my objection to banning this word is, what other word have you got?
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 6 o'clock. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.